So you may or may not know this, but we're being spied upon by these cameras and by these microphones. If you want to find out about that, you can go to PIRSA.org. PIRSA stands for Perimeter Institute Recorded Seminar Archive. And it's modeled, this is something that I've worked on with Steve Bradlock, who's in our IT department. It's modeled on the archive that we'll use. So one of the features it has is that every recording has a unique identifier. So this particular recording is, you can get it by typing in this web address, 07 for the year, 06 for the month, and then 0042, because this is the 42nd talk this month that has been scheduled, or that's been scheduled for this month. So all the talks in this conference are going to be available there. The website is still in development. We'll also have, eventually, a unique identifier for each conference and workshop and each seminar series and so on, and that should be in place in a short while. Okay, so this talk is about operationalism and quantum gravity. It's basically going to be about something I call the causal loop formalism. You can find that in some papers that I've put on the archive recently. So this will be the outline of my talk. So basically, I'll start by giving the motivation for the causal loop formalism. Then I'll explain a certain operational methodology. The technique I'm going to use to construct this framework, which involves three levels of physical compression. Then I'll explain how you can use this framework to make predictions. Predictions in inverted commas for a reason that will become quite clear. So this is a framework of physical theories. I'm going to show how you can put what I want. I'll just explain very roughly how classical probability theory and quantum theory fit into this framework. Classical probability theory. Actually, what I've done is I've put classical probability theory and quantum theory for systems of pairwise interacting qubits into this framework. So that's actually a very general type of physical system, because you can do universal quantum computation using interacting bits in the classical case, interacting qubits in the quantum case. Then I'll say some words about how one might put quantum gravity in the framework. I don't know how to do that yet. But that's the objective of this framework, is to have something with have a mathematical framework which is hospitable to quantum gravity.
Lucy?
Yep.
Is there something missing between 5 and 6?
There won't be in the talk. I'll talk about general relativity. In fact, I'll talk about something which I call probabilistic general relativity, which I haven't yet worked out. So I now have to put quantum theory and classical probability theory into this framework for this interacting qubits and bits. I don't yet know how to put general relativity into the framework, but that's the thing I'm working on at the moment. And then I'll give you a summary. Okay. Good. So let me start with the motivation. So we've got a problem here. We've got two fundamental theories, general relativity and quantum theory. And we want to find a theory of quantum gravity. So theory of quantum gravity, in general, is a theory which reduces to quantum theory and to general relativity in appropriate domains. And appropriate domains has to include, at the very least, domains where those theories are being empirically verified. So that's the basic problem here. And it's a curious problem. There isn't really an algorithm for this type of problem. We're going from two less fundamental theories to a more fundamental one. And of course, it's the subject of a tremendous amount of work. Incidentally, I was talking with Klaus Landsman earlier. One of the real motivations, I think, for quantum foundations, certainly one of the real possible successes that might come out of quantum foundations. In fact, the reason that anyone might think quantum foundations was worthwhile at all in 50 or 100 years' time is because it may lead to techniques for finding a theory of quantum gravity. And so in that sense, it's something I think that everybody who's interested in quantum foundations should think about. Here's how I'm going to approach this problem from the point of view of this particular framework. So we've got these two theories, general relativity and quantum theory, which came to us sort of around the beginning of the last century. And each of them has radical and conservative features. So the conservative feature of general relativity is the deterministic. And the radical feature is that it has a non-fixed causal structure. Quantum theory is conservative and radical in kind of complementary respects. So it's probabilistic that in some sense it's inherently probabilistic. But it's based on a kind of fixed causal structure. So let me just talk about these second two features in each case. So in general relativity, you may have two points, for example, corresponding to the intersection of pairs of particles. And you might want to know whether this interval is space-like or time-like or null. Well, in general, you can't give an answer to that question up front, but rather the answer to that question is determined by determining the metric. And then once you've got the metric, then you can do a calculation as to whether this interval is space-like or time-like. So the causal structure isn't fixed in advance, but rather it's determined by the physical theory itself. Quantum theory has fixed causal structures. Let's think about that. Well, the most obvious feature of fixed causal structure is that the state evolves according to a unitary evolution. So we have this fixed background of time that's there in the back, there telling us how to evolve the state. But there's a more subtle way of seeing that we have fixed causal structure. So consider this situation. So here are two qubits with gates acting on them, A, B, C, D. So each of those gates, and corresponding to each of those gates is some operator. So we have this qubit passing through gate A, this qubit passing sequentially through gates B, C, and then D. And now consider how we would go about putting these operators together within quantum theory. Well, these two operators correspond to space-like separated regions, so we use a tensor product. These two operators correspond to two immediately time-like separated regions acting on the same qubit, so we just use the simple product in that case. And then these two regions are acting on the same qubit, they're time-like, but there's a gap in between. So we can use this operator. The question mark product. And this is defined to be the operator that has this property. Okay. That's a linear operator, and it's something which I've not seen before, but it's there inside the theory it's inside the theoretical structure of quantum theory, and you can work out its properties should you wish. So what's interesting is that the way you combine these operators in each case depends on the particular causal structure that you have. So in this case, they're space-like, so you combine it using the tensor products. In this case, they're time-like, but immediately sequential, so you use this product. And in this case, they're time-like again, but there's a gap in the middle, and so you use the question mark product. And so it seems that in order to know what type of product to use in quantum theory, you need to know what the causal structure is between the two regions. In other words, the causal structure, in some sense, needs to be fixed in advance so you know what product to use. So the fact that you have different products forces you to say upfront what your causal structure is. Okay, so that's not a good situation. And what we would like...
this is crucial. Just for clarification. So right-hand side is the product with this second product. That product being applied to three objects.
Which one? This one? Oh, that's
the...
I'm just trying to show that within quantum theory, you've got these three different types of situations. And actually, you can probably find more complicated situations that have something of the flavor of each of these.
I'm just confused about the two sides of this. I mean, what does it mean?
This is just, so here's an object, a Hankel object, which is defined such that it acts on an operator, returns this. It's a linear object.
It's a super operator.
I wouldn't say it's a super operator. I mean, not in the usual sense of quantum theory, because in quantum theory, super operators correspond to something that acts sequentially on a region. It's not. But can we not get distracted by this? Because it's, the point I want to make is these are different objects for different causal situations. And what would be nice would be, rather than having different objects in each case, if we had a kind of unified product, one product that pertained to all these different types of situations. And so I'm going to define later something which I call the causaloid product. Which will be kind of central to this program. And it provides at least a unified mathematical treatment of all these different types of situations and indeed others. Okay.
Is it not just a time model
product? No. You mean the causaloid?
No, all of these products coincide with the time model product.
Well, this one
doesn't. Field theory.
This one?
Yes, also.
At this stage I'm working within the framework of that's used within quantum information theory, to talk about and such like. You could write down similar statements in field theory. I think then the kind of corresponding problem you have is that whether two operators commute or not depends on whether you have a space-like or a time-like separation.
Yeah.
So if you don't know if you've got a space-like or time-like, then there's all. That's probably the same way to see this sort of issue. I'm not sure to what extent this object exists in field theory, but let's not get distracted by it. Okay. So that's the situation. That's evidence of this causal structure situation of two theories. What we're looking for is a theory of quantum gravity. This is a more fundamental theory. And we expect it to have some relationship between this with these earlier theories. And I think the most reasonable thing is to expect it to take the radical properties in each case. So I think we expect it to at least be probabilistic and have non-fixed causal structure. Actually, I think we expect the situation to be a bit worse than that, because in general relativity, although the causal structure isn't specified in advance, once you've solved for the metric, then at least you have definite causal structure. You know whether the interval, any particular interval, is space-like or time-like. Whereas in quantum theory, we expect to have something like a superposition of different metrics or something of that sort. We expect to have a situation where there's what you might call indefinite causal structure. Which is even worse than really having non-fixed causal structure. So what we want is a framework for physical theories which is hospitable to these properties, so it can be probabilistic and admit indefinite causal structure. Okay. So in order to construct this framework, I'm going to first of all tell you about this operational methodology, and then I'll explain a sort of mathematical technique, which I call physical compression. So first of all, operational methodology. The reason I call it a methodology is, first of all, because it is a methodology, but secondly, because I want to distinguish what I'm doing from being some sort of operational philosophy. I don't know if operationalism is the right way to understand the world at a philosophical level. But I think from a methodological level, operationalism is a very powerful tool. It's weak when it comes to answering questions about reality, for example, but it's strong when it comes to finding some sort of relatively neutral way to proceed in order to construct theories. And you can see various uses of operationalism in the construction of relativity and quantum theory. Heisenberg was very much influenced by that type of thinking. Okay, so here's the operational methodology I'm going to use. So let's imagine we have a physical theory. We have a physical situation. I'll give some examples in a moment. And we're doing an experiment. Okay, this is a physical experiment we're doing. And we're collecting data. And I imagine the data is collected onto cards. Lots and lots of cards. So in one experiment, we'll collect lots and lots of different cards. And on these cards, I'm going to write down data. So the first piece of data corresponds to some kind of location, at which the subsequent data is recorded. And I'll explain in the context of examples how this works. The second piece of data is the sort of choice of measurement or the knob settings. And the third piece of data is the outcomes of those measurements. I'm not going to demand that this location will correspond to some kind of physical measurement, some sort of physical measurement that's taken. But I'm not going to demand that there are any particular properties. I'm not going to demand, for example, that I know two different x's, I know whether the separation is spaced at the time. I won't demand that kind of thing. So here's one example of an experiment. Imagine I have a source followed by three Sturm-Gerlach apparatuses and some particles, some electrons, say, going through there. And in each case, I have a measurement setting. Well, first of all, I can label these devices 0, 1, 2, 3. And then underneath each one, I'm going to write some information on the card. So underneath this one, I write 1, which is the label on this device. And then I write the choice of setting, which can be some angle, beta 1. And then I write the outcome. For example, it might be plus. Then I'll have something similar in each pivot two cases. Okay, so that's just like this. And then, of course, for the source, I'll have some kind of data as well, corresponding to data that tells you that the source is functioning properly. And at the end of this experiment, I would have collected 4 cards. If the experiment was longer, I would have collected 4 cards. If I run the experiment many times, I'll collect many sets of such 4 cards. Okay. So So there's one example. Here's another example. Imagine I have various probes, just drawn two, floating around in space. And each of these probes has on it, so here's a probe, has on it a clock, reading T, has some knob settings, and it has some meters that can say, for example, detect ambient radiation. Okay, so this is a meter. Then what I can do, and here's another one, and what I can do is at each tick time of each probe, I can collect the following data. My X can be the time on this particular probe, let's say this is probe N. And then also all the retarded times read off the other probes. So this is the retarded time on probe N, read at probe N. Okay, that could be my X as an example of something I could use for location. And then I will have the choice of knob settings, this probe, and the readings on the meters.
Oh, so I'm just in this experiment, I'm imagining that this probe is looking at the other probes, and reading through a telescope the times of those probes.
Did your Stern-Gerlach cards have some implied time on them to tell me what happened first, or?
I think there is some implied time there. Yeah. Let's imagine that you actually have a knob, you press the button here, you press that, there's actually a clock next to each one.
Right. So X is generally a space-time.
So yeah, so I'm thinking of this as a space-time location. But I'm not demanding that they have any kind of metric properties at this stage. It's just, it's a label that you read physically somehow that, that I'm going to regard as representing a space-time location. Right. So in this experiment, well, for each tick of each, so for each tick of the clock on each probe, we collect one card. Okay, so if we just consider the situation we have, say, 20 ticks on each probe, we collect 20 cards for each probe times the number of probes, whatever that is. Okay, so we collect that many cards. And then we can repeat the experiment and do it again. The reason for repeating is because we're interested in probabilities. And here I'm thinking in a relative frequency sense. You might want to choose a different way of thinking about probability, in which case you might have a different attitude towards that issue. But that's not something I want to concentrate on. Okay, and then what we do is from the experiment, let's take this one, we bundle all the cards together. Okay, and we send them to a man who sits inside a room with a table in front of him. Okay, there he is. And these cards come into him. And he gets many piles because he repeats the experiment many times. So he has all these piles. Maybe he has them on a side table. He wants his table for something else. Okay, so he has all these piles of cards that he found to go. Okay. Right. So, there's a few things here. The particular order in which the cards are collected is not physically relevant. That's just some circumstance. Any physically relevant information is actually recorded on the cards themselves. So you may say, just to make it more, just to reflect that, you might shuffle the cards in each of the stacks before you bundle them and send them to the guy. Also, the particular order in which the stacks arrive, I'm taking as not being relevant either. So you may shuffle the stacks around before you give them to the guy in the room. Okay. So now, the problem is, I want this guy to analyze the data. And all this guy has is cards, data written on them. I want to find some mathematical framework by which this guy can analyze that data. And the reason that's good is because that's sort of the situation we're in. We get data, we have to analyze it. Of course, this is maybe a slightly more specific than the very general situation you might consider, but this is a pretty accurate reflection of the kind of situation we're in as physicists trying to make sense of the world. And it enforces a particular type of operational methodology. So what I'm going to do is talk about how this guy can go about analyzing that data. So, a few things before I get into the next section.
So we certainly don't get our cars in a random order.
Yeah, well, okay. But all I want to say is, I mean, you in the order in which you collect your data, if you think that order has been actually physically significant, then you should write down that ordering should appear as part of the data that's on your cards, rather than being something that's just left. I mean, just because of the way I'm setting up the problem. So if the ordering is significant, you write the ordering down, included in this cool context. Okay. So this stack has in front of it a big table in addition to this side table. What I'm going to do is imagine that on this big table, he writes down all the different values of x that are possible. And since this is data, there's only a finite set of x's that are possible. So he writes down in different regions on the table. So let's imagine like this. Let's imagine this is the surface of the table. And he draws little circles for each x. Okay, so the whole thing is full of little circles for each x. And then he places the cards from a stack into those circles. Okay, that's what he does. We can think in the following terms. We can imagine taking some, let's call this region R, x, that one here. We can take some bigger region, R1, which is just a collection of these elementary regions. So R1 is some collection of, I'm using set notation, of x's belonging to some particular set. So that's my notion of region, which the guy is just basically constructing from these x labels. And now we ask, what is it this guy has to do? What is his task? What is the thing he wants to be able to calculate? Well, what I want him to be able to do is, right here, is to calculate this type of thing. The probability that, let's imagine we have two regions, two arbitrary regions. The probability that in region two, we see outcomes described by y2. Given that we saw outcomes described by y1, given that we had certain choices and offsettings, f1 in region 1 and f2 in region 2. So basically, this y, for example, is just all the outcomes on the cards that are in this region. Okay. So that's the kind of thing we want to calculate.
So there is some notion of dimensionality in the region.
No.
It's not space-time.
No. Well, in some sense, that kind of represents this notion of location is meant to represent in some sense space-time. But I've not got any notions of dimensionality at this stage. You can just think of this. So these regions, you can mix them up any way you want. It doesn't matter how he draws the little regions on the table. They can be in any order whatsoever, absolutely any order. And these regions, I've drawn it like as if it was connected. Actually, region R1 could be some horribly disconnected thing. Made out of lots of, out of the union of lots of distant smaller regions. Okay. So I'm not assuming anything like that.
To get this notion of probability, you need to assume that you can repeat experiments, right? So different cards sort of belong together, right? The same x label.
So I think this is something that I think is as problematic as you want to make it, which is as much as I mean. This sort of problem can become infinitely problematic because just the philosophy of probability is a deep problem. For the moment, we can just imagine that it's possible to say reset everything so that you can run the experiment again as many times as you like. In the long paper, which is on the archive, I discuss other approaches which don't involve that, which don't involve the notion of repetition. But for the moment, because I want to actually get in place this mathematical framework, let's just imagine that it's possible to reset things.
So, to be more clear for me, so it's impossible to reset because, for example, you do always the experiments later in time all the time. So your coordinate x would be different for each time, for example. You would have a different.
You mean each repetition?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's imagine we can block together. We say we've got some big block of space time where we're not being very particular about the ordering in there. and we do the experiment. Then we have another big block of space-time where we do the same thing again. And that's not ideal. And that's why in the paper I propose a different solution. It's just that solution requires me to get in place this sort of framework, and so I first of all need to discuss.
So these regions would be with respect to curvature or no?
Yeah, they could be, yeah. I mean, this is probably the list that you would pick up. You would be taking data, repeated applications of data in different regions. When we accept a theory of quantum gravity to have probabilities in it, so we need to make sense of those probabilities. If you have a frequency-based interpretation of probabilities, then you need to make sense of that. So this is an issue that you face somehow or another. If you have a different interpretation, then you need to make sense of that also. Probabilities are a really serious problem, I think. I mean, path of probabilities is playing a fundamental role in physical theory at all, isn't it? It's sort of a disaster.
If we have reason to expect that the physical conditions are sort of the same in this region in space over a long period of time, during which we can imagine that.
It's
okay to view this as a repetition of
an
experiment. Right?
Yeah.
But of course, if something changes a lot here, you get a completely different gravitational field or whatever, of course you cannot.
Well, as long as you can get enough instances of the same type of behavior to get probabilities, then you're okay. Otherwise, you need a different interpretation of probability, which is something that I talked about. Or different way of doing things, which is something I do address. Right, so that's as much as I want to say about this operational methodology. But just remember, so this is our objective, to be able to calculate these kind of things. So now, physical compression. So here's the basic notion of what I mean by physical compression. If you look at a physical theory, what physical theories do in general is they relate quantities. So imagine that we have all these different quantities that can be related by a physical theory. Well, we could either write down the values of each of them separately, or we could write down the values of a subset of them and then use the physical theory to calculate the remaining values. So if we were to write down this kind of subset, we would have what you might call a compressed set. That would be a kind of instance of compression. and so what I'm going to do now is give you an example of physical compression that will be reasonably familiar, especially if you were at yesterday's talks. So imagine we have a spin half system. And there's its density matrix. This is the probability of having spin up along the z direction and spin down along the z direction. And you can show that A is equal to px plus minus I p y plus minus 1 minus I over 2 p z plus p z minus two. I might have got the coefficients wrong, but it's a linear formula like that. One day I'll remember those coefficients. So you can show that this is true. And so what that means is that this mathematical object contains the same information. As the density matrix. So this is an equally valid way of representing the state. Okay. Now, if we have this density matrix, we can use it to calculate any probability associated with this qubit. So imagine some arbitrary probability. I'm going to label an arbitrary probability by alpha. So there's all these different things you can measure. You can calculate it by the trace rule. So this is the positive operator associated with this thing that you're asking for the probability of. And Now, this object is linear in this object. And consequently, you can write this down like this. Okay. So what we can see is that we have all these probabilities that can be calculated from this object. So in a sense, what's happened is you have this long list of probabilities, so this alpha might span over all possible orientations of spin measurement you can make. But it's possible to calculate this list, all these probabilities, just by writing down this smaller set of probabilities. So we have a kind of physical, we have physical compression here. From this small set of probabilities, we can calculate this bigger set. So let me just label, rather than calling this set plus, set minus, x plus, and y plus, let me label them 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I'm going to call that label L. That label is L. Well, there's going to be a certain matrix. There's going to be, because this expression is linear, there's going to be a certain linear matrix which will take us from this compressed set back to this bigger set. This is the matrix. And it's just equal to the Lth component of this vector here. Is that clear? So there's a few things to note. First of all, in this case, the compression was linear. You might imagine that in a general physical situation, some other sort of compression might be more efficient. Since I'm going to be looking at probabilistic theories, I'm going to stick with linear compression. There's nothing to stop you just insisting on only looking at a particular type of compression, although that might be inappropriate. If the physical theory, if the underlying physical theory is acting in some more serious nonlinear way. So we have linear physical compression. We end up with a decompression matrix like this. Here we have a subset of the so these probabilities P1 through P4 are actually a subset of all the possible probabilities. So let me write that down again in a slightly different way. Let's not imagine that these are labeled 1 through 4. But just that these L's belong to some particular subset of all the possible L's. Okay. So there's an example of physical compression. So what I want to do now is show you how physical compression works at three different levels. So level one is where I apply physical compression to one of these regions, one of these R1 type regions. Level two compression is where I look at the compression that happens for composite regions, regions that you could regard as being made out of two or more subregions. And this is the compression that happens in some sense over and above level one compression. Level three compression is something different. Again, and I'll wait until I get there before I talk about it. Okay, so level one compression. We're just considering, for the moment, a single region. And now, let's consider this. Well, we also have the big region consisting of everything else, or consisting of everything. And so this region is R minus R1. So let's say in region R1, we have outcomes labeled by Y1. And we have choices and offsettings labeled by F. In region R minus R1, we have outcomes they can provide are, so by y, r minus r1, and offsettings they can provide us. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to regard what happens in this remainder region, the region of r minus r1, as a kind of preparation for what happens inside region 1. So this is a kind of preparation. And then I think of these as being sort of measurements. In the way that we normally think of making measurements on something that's being prepared. One other thing I'm going to do is introduce a label alpha. So I can consider all possible pairs like this. And there are many, in principle, there may be many such possible pairs. And label them by alpha. So alpha just runs over all the possibilities like that. And then just for notational convenience, I'm going to put this alpha on those sets themselves. So now I define this probability. Probability of y1 and yr minus r1 given f1 and fr minus r1. So one thing that's interesting here is this is the joint probability, basically, that you see all the outcomes that you're expecting, given that you had all the choices of knob settings that you had. And then to introduce this alpha, I'll call this thing, since this is region 1, let me call it alpha 1. I'll introduce this label alpha 1 into this expression. Okay. So this thing, piece of alpha 1, is just this probability. It's this big joint probability. Okay. And now I'm going to apply physical compression to this object, just like I did before. Here's a long list of all the possible piece of alpha ones that I could have. I want to compress it down using linear compression to some shorter list. Okay, I'm using the label 1 because I'm in region 1. And this is linear compression. So consequently, I'm going to have, I'll have two things. I'll have an equation like this. P alpha is equal to some R alpha, one in there, dot P. And likewise, I'll have a decompression matrix. One thing that's interesting here relates very much to what Mara was saying in his talk just before, is that I'm using joint probabilities. So this bar is here, it's not here. I'm not using the conditional probability, which would be the more natural thing to do. And in quantum theory, generally, when we define a state, we use the conditional probability because we want to make our state normalized. The reason for that, I think, is mainly psychological. We have this desire for states to be normalized because I don't know why, in fact. But it's not necessary. All that's necessary is that you can calculate the joint probabilities. And then at the very end of your calculation, when you want to get a probability, you can then use Bayes' rule. You don't need to use it before that stage. And this is really important in this context because unlike in the standard operational framework where you have a clear sense of time evolution, a clear sense of what's the past and what's the future, we're in a situation where we don't necessarily have that. And as a consequence, we don't have the condition that Mara wrote down in his talk. We can't assume that we can't assume if we put this conditioning in that it doesn't in some sense become malignant. So that's a serious problem that I struggled with for a long time. And the key is just to use joint polymerases.
Is the purpose of compression to get rid of redundancy of information or for practical reasons?
So the purpose in a sense is to get down to some mathematical object after you apply three levels of compression, you get down to the mathematical object, which is an equivalent specification of the theory. Because the physical theory is in a sense a mathematical is a mathematically compressed way of calculating.
So some redundant information is
Okay, so that's level one compression. Now level two compression. So imagine now that we have a region which we're regarding as composite. And we can regard it as being composite made of just two other regions, or we could consider a situation where we have three regions or four regions, any number of regions. This level two compression, I'm going to show you how it works in the case where we just have two regions, but the same thing, the same type of compression also works when we have more than two regions. And now I'm going to just do level one compression. This situation. Okay, everything is going to be the same as before. So I'm going to write down, well, in here I'll label my possible measurements with alpha 1, and here with alpha 2. And then I can write down this probability. So far, basically the same idea as before. And now I can just think in the same way I did previously. I can compress this down to some smaller set. I've changed this from L to K for a reason that will be clear in a moment. And of course, I'll have a matrix. But actually, let me not write that down. So as before, I'll have this type of formula, P alpha 1 alpha 2 is equal to R alpha 1 alpha 2 the dot P. Okay, and I could use the components of this matrix, of this vector, to get a matrix, which will be the decompression matrix for this. So that's still first level compression I'm describing. It's the same as before. But what we can do, and I won't go into all the details of this, I think you'll see the idea, is we can look at the compression that happens when we have a composite system that's over and above the compression that happens at the first level. So there's a theorem. Here's the theorem. The theorem is that it's possible, it's always possible to choose omega 1, 2 to be a subset, possibly a proper subset, of omega 1 plus omega 2. So, for example, if omega 1 was equal to 1, 2, 3, if omega 2 was 123 also, you can, a possible choice in Amiga 1.2 might be but that's one example. So this is a possible example for filling that type of situation. What this is saying is basically, when you've got these two regions, it always suffices, if you want to do sort of tomography on the state, to only measure the sort of joint probabilities corresponding to these corresponding to the labels that you already had from first level compression. So this theorem is either surprising or not surprising, depending on where you come from. For me, it was surprising. The reason being that it seems to contradict what happens in real Hilbert space quantum theory. But the reason it doesn't contradict that is because we have a kind of different model. In real Hilbert space quantum theory, we're thinking of our basic object is a system, which can interact with, systems can interact, and so they can occupy the same region. Whereas here, our basic objects are disjoint regions. So there's an auto contradiction.
Can you repeat, please, the statement?
Very last thing.
Yeah, of this theorem?
So the statement of this theorem is, if I just apply first level compression to this, okay, I'm going to get some set of labels, Amiga 1. If I apply first level compression to this, I'll get some set of labels, Amiga 2, okay, which basically correspond to the probabilities you have to measure. Amiga 1.2 is the set of joint probabilities you have to measure for the composite region. Now, it turns out, you can prove that Amiga 1.2 can always be a positive subset of the Cartesian product of these two. So here's one example. These might be the probabilities I have to measure for region 1, this region 2. This is the Cartesian, this is one example of the Cartesian subset.
Is it the same that we have in quantum mechanics, right? You have a subset?
Yeah, so in quantum theory, if you have two regions, this is a general theorem for any type of framework that I could, anything that fits within the framework I've described, this is a general theorem. So, and quantum theory will fit within this, so it is true in quantum theory.
Because omega 1 cross omega 2 is not minimal.
What do you mean by minimal?
Omega 1 is not minimal as a informational.
Oh, actually, one thing I didn't emphasize is that I'm assuming that this linear compression is maximal. I'm applying as much linear compression as possible in each case. So that's why the theorem is surprising. Yeah. So this is the maximum amount of compression at the first level that is possible, and this is the maximum amount of compression here. So it turns out that this is true. It's very simple to prove, but it's surprising, perhaps, if you thought about real values at Hilbert space. So you can see there are kind of two situations you can have here. One situation where this is just equal. And that is kind of a trivial situation. What that is saying is that there's no additional compression for a composite region over and above the compression that you had already for the two component regions. So that's the trivial case. And then the non-trivial case is where it's a proper subset. And in that case, you have some non-trivial second-level compression. Do you have a question?
I just wanted to know if you require your decompression to work exactly, or are you working with information?
This is exactly. This is not really the same kind of compression that you have in.
So this is not just a statement about mutual information being positive.
No. This is really a very different sort of compression concept than the kind of concept you have in quantum information theory or classical information.
So the reverse will always give you the.
Yeah. So the reverse is meant to be some matrix that. I mean, you can start to think in those that way, but at this stage. This decompression matrix will give you from that which is what we have in quantum theory. The example I gave you.
Except that you might want to say you reproduce it, except with some small probability.
Okay. That might be an interesting route to pursue, but at this stage, it's meant to be exact. Okay. So then what we can do is we can quantify the exact form of the second level compression by having a matrix which tells us how to go from the components in here to the components in here. So the components in here, I'll label them by L1, L2. Okay. And components in here by K1, K2. And we can write down a matrix like so, which quantifies the second level compression. And I haven't shown you exactly how that comes about, but I think you can see that this kind of linear matrix is going to exist there in the theory. And now we can use this to define something which I call the causal loop product. So let me use this board. So you can show that this vector is given by taking the components of this. Or I can write that down in a compact notation. R alpha 1 alpha 2 is equal to R alpha 1 causal loop product R alpha 2. And this thing is the generalization that we were looking for. If you choose a particular second-level compression matrix, then you can realize any one of these different types of products within this different framework. So you have to put quantum theory into my framework, and then you can do that. And then what's interesting is that actually, of these three cases, the only one that's non-trivial, the only one where you have a proper subset, is this one. So there's a strong connection between non-trivial second-level compression and what you might call causal adjacency. The reason you can get non-trivial second-level compression is if there's some kind of influence passing between the two. So you need fewer probabilities to specify the state of the combined region. Okay, so...
What's different in causal adjacency and just a timeline separation? Is the same notion or different?
Causal adjacency, I'm thinking of immediate expected timeline separation.
At this stage, you're not yet into time-like separation.
Well, if you have a time-like separation but with a gap, then actually you have trivial.
You don't have that gap. You're still
time-like. But imagine you have something here and something here, and there is a gap. That's a different situation from if there isn't a gap. In this situation, within the model I have of quantum theory, you get trivial second-level compression. Don't forget, this is within a finite Hilbert space context. If you're in a continuous Hilbert space context, you probably have some kind of continuum effect, which I haven't studied. Okay. Have I said it? Right, okay. So that So that's basic. So there's a third level of compression. So there's the two technical parts of the talk that I should probably still give. The third level of compression and how you use this framework to make predictions, which won't take long. Okay, so the third level of compression. What you can see what's happened now is that from the first and second levels of compression, you've got all these matrices. So here are some matrices that you have. This is one where you have second level compression for three regions. And so on. And you can have these matrices between all different pairs of regions in this space. So there are many, 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 many possible such matrices. So third level compression is where I take this long list of possible matrices and I compress it down to a shorter list. We just label them with J. So I have some shorter set of of these matrices taken from this very long list. And then I have also a set of rules by which I can accomplish the decompression. So third level compression is kind of different to the first two levels. And it's something that I haven't worked out how to do in general. I've only worked out how to do it for the particular cases of classical probability theory and quantum theory with interacting bits and qubits. But it's still very instructive. And basically what happens is these rules consist of, or these rules are implemented by using certain identities between all these matrices. So one identity, for example, is that if the omega sets, so for example, imagine you have that situation, then the corresponding gamma matrices factor also. Okay, so that's one type of identity we have. Then we have other types of identities that are more interesting, but we have a set of identities we can use to implement rules by which we can go backwards. And I'll show you very briefly how that works in the case of quantum theory and classical probability theory. And so what happens is this object that you get after three levels of compression is the thing I call the causaloid. I didn't know it like that. So this object, the causaloid, is the thing that you get after applying three levels of compression to your physical theory. It's sort of this object is as compressed as you can make it by these techniques anyway. And this object is essentially your theory. Using this object, as I'll show you, you can then calculate the probabilities that you want to be able to calculate. So let me show you how to do that. And there's a very interesting lesson to be learned here, I think, for quantum gravity. Something that if you start taking fuzzy or indefinite causal structures seriously, then you have to think much more carefully about what you mean by making predictions in a physical theory. Okay, so this is section four. So imagine I want to calculate this. The probability of y2 given y1 given f1, f2. Okay, so I've got two regions, like so. I've got some knob settings in each of the regions, and I've got some outcomes. And I want to calculate this conditional. probability. So now I'm calculating the conditional probability. How do I calculate that? Well, I use Bayesian. And you can write it down as being equal to let me label this alpha 2, alpha 1. I'll explain the notation in a moment. So in the denominator here, I'm summing over beta, and beta is all the possible, beta 2 is all the possible y2s, all the possible outcomes that are consistent with the given choice of knob settings for region 2. Okay. So if I chose to measure spin along the x direction in region 2, then beta 2 would consist of the x up and the x down labels, for example. And then alpha 2 would be just one of those two labels. So I'm calculating this probability. But there's a problem with this equation. It depends on the state p. Well, the state p is something that's determined by the preparation outside of the region under consideration. So the state p is something that's associated with y r minus r1 and r2 and f r minus r1 plus r2, which isn't part of the thing I'm trying to calculate. So this conditionalization, this state is determined by information that isn't part of the thing I'm trying to calculate. So the only way this can make sense is if this equation is independent of p. Okay. And then the only way that can be true is if this object is parallel to this object. Let me call this, well, this is what you do. Let me call this, the only way that this formula can be independent of the state is if R alpha 1, alpha 2 is parallel to R alpha 1 dash. That's just as simple. I mean, you can see that if these two things are parallel, it doesn't matter what dot product you take. And then since this state P can span the whole space of possible, the whole vector space available to P, then it's going to be true in general. Okay. So it turns out this probability is only defined as it's written if this condition is satisfied. The probability is well defined if and only if this is true. And in this case, the probability, which I'll call P, is then given by this equation. Then we just take the ratio of these lengths.
Can you reiterate the reason? So you objected to the probability being dependent on regions outside.
Because the thing I'm calculating doesn't specify what happens outside. So let me give an example. So
what's the problem of just saying it should be included there?
Well, because I want to know how to calculate this. If you calculate something in the theory, you don't want to have to be forced to include all sorts of conditions you weren't interested in. So let me give an example, because this will explain why it's important. So here's an example. Imagine we have three standard Laplace matrices in a row. Okay. Say I want to calculate the probability that the last one, the third one, gives spin up along the z direction. Given that the second one had spin up along the y direction. Okay. I could use quantum theory to do that to get a well-defined answer. On the other hand, if I want to use quantum theory to calculate what happens at the third standard apparatus, conditioned only on what happened at the first one, without saying anything about what happened at the second one, well, then I can't use quantum theory to do that. And the difference between those two situations is in the causal structure. Now, normally, in a physical theory, we have a kind of tradecraft associated with knowing what kinds of things you can calculate. And usually we're referring that to the causal structure. So there's this tradecraft. We say, well, we have this definite causal structure. That tells us what we can calculate. And so those are what the formulas do. Quantum theory is, you know, quantum theory, for example, and other theories also, don't tell us anything if the causal structure is wrong. And but it's still, we can still ask the question, you know, is the probability well defined? It's such a situation. But now what we're doing is we're mathematizing the question. We have a mathematical condition. Rather than having a tradecraft, we're not saying, well, you know, let's look at the causal structure, see if this is the sort of thing I'm allowed to calculate. We have a mathematical condition, which is basically will be satisfied if the causal structure is doing what it should. And if it is satisfied, then we're in a position to calculate the probability. So the thing we have to give up, the thing we have to realize if we have to take indefinite causal structure seriously, is that normally we calculate things with reference to causal structure. So the thing we have to give up is we have to give up being able to always have an answer. We only have an answer if the conditions are, the causal conditions are right for having an answer. Otherwise, we don't. And I think that's conceptually difficult to get your head around.
And you would say in your Stangaroff apparatus case, where you don't know what's going on in the middle, that's the wrong causal conditions.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, in that case, quantum theory doesn't tell you what's going to happen, what the problem is.
But isn't that sort of a trivial case? I mean,
well, I'd say it's the generic cases where you don't know.
Yeah.
The generic cases where, so I mean, there's a slightly different model which I should talk about, is to think of the adversary model. So let's imagine you want to calculate the probability, you want to write it down, and then someone is going to try and mess that up. Well, if you haven't specified, you know, in that standard for example, what the middle thing is, then some guy can come along, an adversary, and mess up your prediction by doing something in there, make it wrong. You're turning this on you. Okay, let me just. So, one thing I haven't shown you is how quantum theory fits this very much. I'm not going to do that. I've never managed to do it yet in the talk. So, this one should be no exception. Let me just tell you how. Let me just outline a rough program for this is point six, for how I imagine you might be able to get a theory of quantum relativity. And this is very tentative, and the most difficult problems haven't even been touched yet. So we've got something we might call classical probability theory. You can think of this as the theory of, for example, what would happen if you had interacting qubits. We have quantum theory. Here's a theory that I'm going to call probabilistic GR, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And then we've got the thing we're aiming at, which is quantum gravity. Quantum gravity. Okay. That's the thing we're aiming at. And I can draw various arrows on this. Well, this process going from classical probability theory to quantum theory is a process that I understand relatively well within this framework. You might call it kind of quantization. And this is the word quantization with quotation marks appearing again. For the second time today. And then here, we have another kind of process. We might call it GRization. So what's happening in quantization, which what's really interesting, is that quantization, going from this to this, seems to be something which happens only at level one compression. What's interesting is that levels two and level three compression are basically the same in these two systems. The only thing that's different is level one compression. So basically what you have to do is replace the simplex of classical probability theory with the sort of block sphere of quantum theory. And that's a level, that's something you can do at level one. Once you've done that, everything else is going to follow through. I haven't constructed this theory of probabilistic GR yet, but my My suspicion is that it will differ from this in terms of how it treats level 2 and level 3 compression. So if that's true, a way of arriving here is to implement level 1 quantization here, or a change at level 1 to implement quantization here, and some sort of change at level 2, level 3, to input the general relativistic aspect of this. that's the plan. It might just work. So probabilistic general relativity. So strictly speaking, the thing that should be naturally compared with the other objects in this, the thing that GR should naturally compare with is classical probabilistic theory. So the thing we need is some kind of stochastic or probabilistic version of general relativity. So the obvious way to do that would be just to take solutions for the metric across space-time and then take some probabilistic mixture and you'd get a kind of stochastic general relativity. The trouble is that's kind of non-local. Apart from the interpretational problems associated with that, it's kind of a non-local thing. You have to have the whole solution, then you take mixtures of them. That's not very satisfactory. Another thing you could do is take some sort of canonical version of general relativity and then take a mixture of different solutions at each space-like slice as you evolve it. But again, that's non-local in space, even if it is local in time. So what we really want here is something, and I don't know how to do it, which is both local in space and time. And what I'm hoping is to put a probabilistic version of general relativity into this causaloid framework, or at least an appropriately modified version of it, in order to implement this type of program. So let me just summarize. So we have this causaloid framework. We can put quantum theory, at least a certain version of quantum theory, classical probability theory, also into this framework. And I'm hopeful that we can put GR in this framework or something that's very similar to it. The framework doesn't have a background time. There's not some background time you have to refer things to here. In that sense, it's properly operational. The operational descriptions that we've heard so far at this conference are not operational with respect to this background time. In fact, you say this is a preparation transformation system. You know which is which. And one of the things that comes along with that, I think, is the notion of system. If you're not operational with regard to time, then you end up inserting this anti-operational notion of system. This approach doesn't do that. It tells you something possibly interesting here that I think will end up being a feature of any theory of quantum gravity, is that you have to be careful about what it is you can predict. You're probably going to have this situation where there are certain things you simply can't predict. And so you have to have some condition that mathematizes what definite causal structure did for you in the past. You have to bring that into physical theory. I guess I'll stop there. Thank you. Good, I'm just checking. I know.
I think you won't be surprised. But it seems to me that you can't really discover anything about the world, let alone compare it in this way. Because maybe I haven't understood what's going on. But because all you're collecting is the data and having mathematical operations. Suppose I'm sitting in that black box. What does it tell me? This data and this compression rules, it might tell me something about quantum theory, classical theory, because I already know something about quantum theory. So all we know, nothing like quantum theory or classical theory would be discovered. How am I going to discover that within this?
Okay, so the answer is probably that you won't. I mean, so this is a methodology. I've got some operational methodology to construct a framework. I think what's good about this is that if you try to proceed blindly with a framework which is inhospitable to the kinds of things that you need to import into theory in the first place, then you're going to run into trouble. And the problem of time, for example, in quantum gravity, is possibly one symptom of this problem. So the point is to get in place our framework, which is potentially rich enough. And then, in a sense, you can leave behind the operational reasoning you've got there. You've now got a mathematical framework. The question is, can you bring in maybe some other principles from somewhere else? I don't know where you get those from. So to complete this into a physical theory, because you're right, at this stage it's just a mathematical framework.
Just looking forward. This is very ahistorical way of discovering things. This is not how things have been discovered. So, of course, it's going to be a new way. For all we know, historically,
I disagree. I think it's very historical. I mean, Einstein, especially in specialism, he was able to divest himself of various misplaced ontological concepts by reasoning operationally. Yes. And he did the same thing. You can argue that this played a role also in general relativity, although maybe to a lesser extent. And also in quantum theory, there was this process. I mean, okay, it wasn't exactly this, but it was operational reasoning, I think, that got us there.
Another question? Yeah. I'm surprised when you say that this quantization only involves first-level compression. And that's because you said that in your quantum theory that you invented in this framework, that the second-level compression is the only non-trivial one, and that corresponds to the composition of operators.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps I'm not understanding, but in classical probability theory, would be some difference there?
So, I read them out. I have three examples of the way you see operators together in quantum theory,
mm-hmm.
and you have exactly analogous things in classical theory. The difference is perhaps in the number. So the difference is that if you just got a classical bit, then your Omega set only has two labels in it. You only need two probabilities, P2, to specify a classical bit. Whereas in the quantum case, you need four for the analogous situation. So one thing that happens at the first level is the number of quantities involved is increased. But once you go to the second level, the way you put together these quantities in the two cases, similar types of causal situation, is essentially identical. The only difference is inherited from the fact that you have a bigger set in the quantum case than in the classical case.
I have just one question. So the fact that you get that you can get quantum theory in this framework is sort of closer. I can sort of see that maybe you can do that because quantum theory, the outcome of quantum theory is always some probabilities that we calculate.
Right.
So it seems closer to the framework that you set up here. But when you talk about GR, there's a lot of things that forget about. Probabilistic GR, just GR.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that you haven't even sort of touched on, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Metrics, distances, mass of flow, all these things. And these are very, I don't know, these notions are somehow very far from what you set up. So,
right.
I mean, how does that help? How am I going to get to these things?
With difficulty for sure, but I mean, this is the thing I've been thinking about for the last year and a half or so. So I don't think the framework is quite as fitable to GR as it stands. I think in GR you have notions of distances and those dynamical notions.
Right.
So I think therefore on your cards it isn't enough to have only cards that have values of things at points. I think
right.
you need to have a slightly richer notion of things of this cards that have not just values of things at points, but also cards that have distances between at least those points or something like this.
Or at least relations.
Relations, and in GR this is just primarily distance. I mean, this is the metric aspect is distance, and there's also mass, which is, so that's the one thing. In terms of this being probabilistic or not, if you look at the classical case, well, you can kind of recover determinism by just looking at the extremal points in the sort of probability simplex in the classical case, and only considering deterministic evolutions. So one would hope that something similar that something similar maps into prop GR. One of the interesting things about this is it forces a certain type of conceptual well, I say clarity is a handle there, but it forces you to attempt to achieve a certain type of conceptual clarity with regard to GR, namely operational clarity. And that's actually quite difficult. I mean, GR is operationally, I mean, it's a difficult theory, I think. It's,
yeah, no, I'm very sympathetic to that. But basically, what my question is that there's sort of this clarity that you're talking about is a bit divorced from this setup. I agree that you have to be very clear about it. But you can be very clear about it, even if you don't have this.
But at the very least, I think whatever this theory is, it will be about data in the end.
Yeah.
Okay. And this framework tells you about data. So as long as you start with the right type of way of setting things up about how you collect data, then you should be able to do it.
And Robin?
So, regarding the center board there, if I try to compute probability of Y2 given Y1, et cetera, and I find that there's a deterministic relation, then I can be certain that I haven't left anything out. You said essentially that if it ends up depending on this state,
yeah,
and I've left something out,
yeah,
and the quantity is not well defined.
Yeah.
But if it's a non-deterministic relation, if it's a probabilistic relation, and I'm the guy in the black box, how do I know whether it's just a non-deterministic relation or I've left out something important and this isn't well defined?
So we imagine this guy in the black box is collecting data from actually also all different types of choice settings, all different types of choices and subsettings. So he can go through, and you know, with his tables that he compiles, say, look, when this thing is stable, it doesn't matter what's happening elsewhere, this probability is always well defined, so it's a certain value. The probability it only depends on what the conditioning is here. If he's going in that direction, of course we want a theory sitting in the opposite direction, you can say, given that circumstance, I know that it's well defined.
But he can, for instance, look at how that quantity depends on some other variable Y3.
Exactly.
And if it does, then he sets off an alarm.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. That's if he's going in the direction of trying to construct this framework. If
right.
he's got the framework, then he knows from this condition that it's.
Tell me if I'm confused. But so the causal structure is supposed to be somehow encoded into this object, the causal line, right?
Yeah.
And in the beginning of the seminar, you said that causal structure might be, you know, indefinite or not definite. So does it mean you will have linear superpositions of different causal lines, or is that?
No.
And then the question is then how could you implement the idea of indefinite causal structure if there's going to be this definite object in your theory?
Okay. So there is a definite object. It's just it's one of, you know, the physical theory is in a sense. I smog into this object. This object tells you what the physical theory is, causally. And then what's going to happen is if you look at, say, second-level type of compression situations, you'll have different types of situations. You'll have those situations that correspond to the trivial situation. And that's very much like space-like case of quantum theory or the time-like with a big enough gap. And then you'll have situations where you have kind of extreme second-level compression that corresponds to this immediate sequential thing. And that's in some sense extreme, because in some sense all the information is passing through. You'll have intermediate situations which you can regard as indefinite causal structure. It's just a situation it's a sort of stochastic situation where you wouldn't necessarily want to say it's space-like or time-like. In a sense, it doesn't matter. What we are thinking is this notion of space-like and time-like is, once you understand that it's a tool for helping you, to know how to calculate probabilities. Once you understand that that's what it's doing, and you can leave it behind and say, well, I've got a different set of tools now. I've mathematized that type of problem in a different way. I don't even need to know what space-like and time-like is. I've got a different mathematical framework that I can use to do that. And then I can try to see what's happened. And you'll just get some kind of stochasticity with regard to any attempt to impose a natural concept of space like all the time.
From this causal line, can I extract the causal set or something like that? Or
Only in special cases. So in the case of quantum theory, for example, if I put quantum theory in this framework, then I would be able to extract the causal structure. So for example, if I put the quantum theory of interacting qubits, then I'll extract the causal structure that basically relates to the paths these qubits are traveling along. But in a more general theory, that might not be the case. You wouldn't have definite causal structures, you wouldn't be able to. And one thing that's interesting is, so usually people think the usual approach is to quantum gravity, or definitely the approach is to have a superposition of definite causal structure situations. So you have, here's my graph of some sort, that's a definite causal structure. Here's another one, that's another definite causal structure, and then take a superposition. Whereas this isn't like that. It's a bit like the difference between thinking about quantum theory in terms of pure states and taking superpositions, and thinking about quantum theory in terms of density matrices, where you don't really care about how that's realized.
So this is sort of some kind of generalization of having a causal structure, because in most cases, probably you don't have anything like
causal. In a sense, it's, usually your causal structure is, your definite causal structure, it has very simple values on the line, say 0 or 1. Space type or time, whereas in this case, essentially, you've got matrices associated with pairs of regions, rather than a simple.
So, but in principle, then, when you come to a more classical, maybe a more big time form or something, would you give dynamics to this object, the causal
argument? No, the causal. The whole point of this is there's no time of it. The whole point was to get away from thinking in terms of time evolution.
Just dynamics.
You've specified the object. And then you know how to use the object via these equations to make predictions. That's all you need.
Is it a priori? Is it part of your theory that I'm saying this is the causal oil, and that will be the case for all scenarios, or whatever I consider?
Your causal oil has to be for if you know the causal oil for the most general type of situation that you can apply to all different scenarios.
Well, you do need to get.
No, you don't need to, but you can. This is the point. So normally, we're very used to thinking of the physical world in terms of a state evolving in time. It's very difficult to get away from that. The conceptual need to have that. However, in our physical theories, that idea of a state evolving in time, all it's doing for us really is enabling us to calculate such types of correlations. Okay. So fine, you can have that if you want or not, but I don't care. I've just told you how to calculate correlations. I've sidestepped that usual picture of having an evolving state. And what was interesting is at the very end, even the notion of state I did talk about is completely out of the picture. I'm just using this dual space objects.
Okay, so maybe this is the time to stop and thank you.